All right. Okay, so tonight we're going to talk about the Hebrew month of Av. So the Hebrew months have names. The names are not actually Jewish, turns out. We call the months by their numbers. The names are actually Babylonian in their origin, but we still work with those names and deal with them. So the name of this month is Av, which means father. And so you might wonder, could this be the father of all months? Like, when we have categories of Av, what does that mean? So we're not actually going to go into that here. But I will tell you that this month actually has a double name. So from tonight until the 9th, we call it Av. And from the 10th and on, we call it Menachem Av, the comforting Av. Because this is the most difficult month of the year. This is a month of pain and a month of sorrow. And it's difficult to enter it. So, and it's interesting to think about, why do we have this planned time of distance and pain in our calendar? What's this about? And how do we approach it? How do we feel that distance? And then how do we close the gap? That's what I really want to focus on. But first I want to just focus on the distance for a minute. So who here has been to Yellowstone Park? Almost everybody, I hope. Yellowstone Park. Yellowstone Park, right? So you know in Yellowstone Park there's that figure eight drive, basically a large figure eight drive. And there's lots of attractions. You can stop along the way and see all the different things. But everything, the mammoth hot springs and Old Faithful and the ink pots and the whatever it is, all of them are powered underneath by one thermodynamic system, which expresses itself differently according to the aperture in the earth that it expresses itself through. Right? Does that make sense so far? Underneath one huge volcano, if it blows, don't worry about it. It actually pays to be there when it blows. Because nobody is going to survive. Okay, it's huge. So not in Oregon either. So nobody has to worry about visiting because if it blows, we're gone anyway. So my kids just visited and they were worried. Should we get trip insurance, Ima? I'm like, don't worry about it. You won't need it. Just see the park and enjoy it for however long it's there. So the year is sort of like that too. Powered by one spiritual system, but each month is an aperture through which that spiritual energy flows down towards us. And we need to figure out, how do we tap into that spiritual energy? What is the flow that's happening around us? And how can we gain from that? How can we gain from the energy that's available? So this month is the energy of separation. These first 9 days are the energy of separation. And it is a difficult time. Why did it happen? I mean, we could talk about historical reasons why this might have happened. There was initially as the Jews were traveling through the desert and considering going into the land, being told to go into the land, so they sent spies. The spies came back with a negative report. All the Jews started to cry, wail, and moan. It's going to be so hard, giants, and difficulty, and we love being in the desert, and you know. And all the complaining they did in the desert, and then there's complaining again to go into the land, and people believed it's going to be so difficult, and everybody started to cry. And God said, you're crying now? I'll give you something to cry for. But that's what the Midrash says, right? It says, you're crying tears of nothingness, I'm going to give you something to cry for throughout the years. So you might think, what kind of mean father is that? You know, he's our father. Is he treating us in a mean way, a vindictive father like that? You're crying for nothing, I'll give you something to cry about? What's up with that? And yet, we have on the 9th of Av, that's the energy that caused it, or perhaps that was the energy that was flowing, that was then manifested in, that's what converged with this spy report to create this energy of distance. Maybe there was an energy of distance there that they tapped into and the whole thing converged. But anyway, on the 9th of Av is when a lot of negative things happen. First temple destroyed, second temple destroyed. Bar Kokhba revolt, I think, was put down at that time. Shots of the First World War, the Spanish expulsion was the 9th of Av. There's all kinds of bad stuff that happens on the 9th of Av. I think the Warsaw Ghetto, I think, fell on the 9th of Av. All kinds of bad stuff happened on the 9th of Av. So this is a time to actually lay very low. We don't do anything dangerous during this time. No court dates. It's a bad time for the Jews. No court dates. We don't... no celebrations, and no dangerous things, no river rafting, no things that we might be a normal danger that we would take, we drive, but we shouldn't speak during these 90s. It's just not good right now. It's not a good time for the Jews. Why and how can we flip it around? How can we understand what's this distance about? So what's going on with us being at, we're a little bit out of sync in our relationship with God, and we have to get back into sync. So let's look at a pattern that we have that's going in the Jewish year. One way, only one, of many ways to understand the flow of the holidays and what's happening with them. So, which is the first holiday? Does anybody know? It's a trick question, but yeah.
Pesach, that's right.
Pesach is the first holiday of the year, not Rosh Hashanah. That's why I said it's a trick question. Pesach is the first holiday. So starting from the first holiday, we can see the Jewish people is born. So that's our birth. Right? So the Jewish people are born, we're brought to Mount Sinai, and we grow up a little bit, and we have that 7 weeks in between Passover and Shavuos. Shavuos is like a wedding, right? God holds the mountain over us like a wedding canopy, because there's a whole long story there, which we're not going to go into right now, but that's our wedding. We marry God there. Then, apparently, Tisha B'Av is the affair. That's the adultery, right? We walk away from the relationship, and God gets pretty ticked off, right? Then, after Tisha B'Av is 7 weeks of consolation. So we read 7 Haftorah readings of consoling passages from the prophets. And then comes Rosh Hashanah, judgment. Now let's see where we are. We had the affair, did a little consolation work, now we're judging. Then there's the repentance. I'm really sorry. Shouldn't have done it. I have to return to you. And then there's Yom Kippur, forgiveness. Total forgiveness. And then there's Sukkot, celebration. So when we make a party, it's the happiest of all the holidays, is Sukkot. And we celebrate the deepened relationship, the depth that's there of the breached relationship that's been repaired and deepened by the work that's been done from the breach to the repair. A lot of us get stuck. Many people, I'm guessing, in this room are thinking, affair? I would never go back. Right? Some people are thinking, affair? I went back already. But some people are thinking, affair? What do you mean affair? That's such a breach. Why go back? And if we think that way, and I'm not right now discussing our marriages, but really relationships, sometimes in a strong breach, that is when we walk away from the relationship. And this is coming to teach us that a strong breach, even a very strong breach, is not necessarily cause to walk away. It may be a cause to turn inwards and deepen and move forward. It's interesting what happens, though, before the judgment, before the reassessment of the relationship on Rosh Hashanah, comes the month of Elul, right? But during the month of Elul, that's where we read 4 of those 7 haftorahs of consolation. So we have some consolation before the judgment. We do a little softening before the assessment, right? So we certainly do tshuva during the month of Elul, but even before that starts, right away, as soon as Tisha B'Av is over, we right away change the name of the month to Comforting Av, and that first Shabbos is called the Shabbos of Comfort. Shabbos Nachamach, the Shabbos of Comfort. And we start right away into comfort and then into the work of the relationship, reassessment and repentance and forgiveness and then celebration. Yeah.
I love the fact that we don't just get to go into Rosh Hashanah, that we have to go to people and say, I'm really sorry.
Right.
That we have to be responsible for our behavior. And when you were, just one more thing, and when you were talking about God and, you know, what we're saying, it's like, I see God going, all right, you saw the Red Sea part, and you still question everything I'm doing. For God's sake,
Come on.
Is that correct?
I forget what he was saying.
You saw the Red Sea part.
I know, and everything else, the 10 plagues, the whole shebang, and like, where were we? Really? I think there was a lot, I think it was pretty darn frustrated. And Moshe said, and God said to Moshe, you know what, Moshe, I have had it. I've had it with this people. I am starting fresh. Me and you, Moshe, it's going to be me and you. Abraham and his descendants, wiping them out. It's going to be you, your descendants, and me. We're starting fresh because this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And what did Moshe say?
Give them another chance.
He said, not me and you, God. I'm with them. You're wiping them out? Take me with them. Take me out of your book because I'm on their side. So if you want me, you have to take them. Give them another chance. Yeah. Yeah, that's what he said. Write me out of your book or take them back. And he did. God took them back. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes it pays to stick up, right? For somebody who's in distress. So he did.
So he really had that sense of fidelity and loyalty and reaching out for people who did something pretty bad, right? And he stuck. That is the power of a leader in love, right? A leader who loves the people that he's leading or that she's leading, is to say, I love you no matter what. And I really feel that. Sometimes I go to people's houses and they think I'm joking. They'll say, oh, don't look, it's so messy. Or don't look, now that you see what my, you know, how I yell at my kids, like, don't judge me. I'm like, I'm not judging. I love you no matter what. You know, I love you no matter what. So, and it's something that I've worked on with my kids who have gone in many different ways, from religious to not religious, but I love them no matter what. Took a while to get there. I love them no matter what. So what about God? Do we love God no matter what? Let's think about this. This is something that is a little difficult for us sometimes. Like, when do we say, I've had it with you, God? Does he say that to us, I've had it with you? Maybe. Do we feel that he said that? Or sometimes we say that to God. You know, like, really, you're treating me this way? I'm not sure I want to be in this relationship. And sometimes we get to that place. That happened for my husband one day, unfortunately. My daughter waited for 4 years to have babies, to have a baby. She conceived twins, delivered them, and just 2 weeks later, one of them died. My husband was pretty mad about it. Now, this daughter is a very special daughter. She married a quadriplegic. She's Hatzadikas. She really is a very special, holy person. And she married a very special, holy person. She knew, marrying somebody in a broken body, that this was a union of souls. And it took a while for the souls to manifest through their bodies of pregnancy that helped in twins. But here she has twins and one dies. My husband was mad at God. That shocked us. We went through a long, you know, a period of waiting, like, what was this gonna happen? Would she survive? No. Anyway, that Shabbos morning, we're sitting on the couch and we're chatting a little, we had breakfast, we're chatting. And I said, you know, I think it's time for shul. He said, well, I'm not going. I said, wow, you sound pretty mad. He said, I am mad. I said, you sound, you know, pretty mad. He said, I'm mad. I said, I'm mad at God for killing my granddaughter. I am mad. He said, I'm so mad at God, I wish I could kick him in the shins. I said, oh, okay, then why don't you stay here? But I think I am going to go to shul. He said, you should go to shul. He said, because God needs a talking to, and you're the one to do it. All right, then. Then that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to shul and talk to God. I'm not going to give him a talking to, I'll talk to God, right? So now I'm walking to shul by myself after that conversation, and I'm thinking, what just happened here? That was very interesting, right? And I thought about this, like, emunah continuum, this faith continuum. Emunah is a different word in Hebrew than it is in English for faith, but that's the closest translation. Faith, trust. Let's call it faith, trust. Emunah. All right, so the Emunah continuum. First, there's this lateral line, this horizontal line of where we believe stuff. So the first thing is, there is a God. Then it continues. He made the world. He runs the world. He runs my world. He runs my world for the good. Now, a lot of people are somewhere on that continuum, and most religious people, I'm saying in quotation marks, believe all that stuff. Then how is it that a religious person could sell trade meat for kosher? Right? Or cut you off in traffic? Or be nasty to you? Or perpetrate sexual abuse? Or whatever? And they believe God runs the world. How could they do that and believe God runs the world? So then there's got to be depth in all those beliefs. Do they really believe it? How much do they really believe it? Do they really believe there's a God? Do they really believe he made the world? Do they really believe he runs the world? Do they really believe he runs the world for the good? Do they really believe he runs my world for the good? So I realized that for my husband, he had stopped somewhere at, there is a God, he made the world, he runs the world, done. And he killed my granddaughter. That's what he did. With his abilities, that's what he did. And I'm mad at him. Because he's not running the world for the good, but he does run the world. So it's his fault, and he's mad. So we worked with that for a bit, and then, unfortunately, we lost a son the following year. And my husband was not mad about that. And I thought, that's pretty interesting. You know, there was sorrow, certainly, but there wasn't anger in that. And I was thinking, where is the you know, there wasn't the anger in it. We knew he died of mental illness. We expected that death. It was a while in coming, but it came. It was still a shock when it came, but there was some expectation of it. So in a way, it was like a cancer death. You're still surprised. It was still too young. It still came. It was still painful. And yet, there wasn't anger about it. And so I think, why isn't there anger about this? Nevertheless, our family needed help, and we needed some counseling, and I was trying to find, you know, some therapist. So I'm the mom who lost the kid, but I'm trying to now find the therapist because I'm still the mom for the family, which we never found that therapist. But in my efforts to find that therapist, I sent a few emails, right? Looked people up and sent an email to somebody, Sally Smith, at Comcast, looked like the best one. And the email got bounced back. Then, okay, Sally Smith at Comcast.net, I had composed a paragraph explaining like some of the dynamics of our family, what the loss we experienced, and can she help with that? And it got bounced back, so I thought, you know, I'll just try Sally.Smith at Comcast.net. Send that, it goes through. A day later, I get an email saying, I'm not a therapist. The more you emailed me, it's a different Sally Smith. So, but I have a sister who lost a son the same way you lost yours. So I forwarded her the email, just maybe she could have something to share with you. So her sister writes me. She's Catholic. She writes me, and she writes me a lovely email that I could reach out to her at any time, and we have to be people of faith. She doesn't know that I'm Jewish, and she doesn't know that I am a person of faith, but I have to be people of faith, and we can never be mad at God, and we just have to accept what God says. And she sends me a bunch of verses from Job, and, you know, just to console me a little bit, and to strengthen me that I should accept this without anger. So I wrote her back and I thanked her so much. I don't remember if I told her or if I just told somebody else about that, but I was thinking, well, but as Jews, we can be mad at God. We can. That's something that we're allowed to be, because anger is part of a relationship. And to say that you could only feel one way in a relationship is denying the depth and the complexity of a relationship. And so anger and frustration and disillusionment, and it is part of the relationship. And that's part of our relationship with God, that we can actually embrace. And that's what this time period helps us do. So I did not experience anger over my son's death. Of course, some despondence and frustration. That later, so he died in May, and the following spring, I had enough energy to plant a garden. So I planted a garden, and I named it my garden of distraction and consolation. Right, and the weather was beautiful in March, and I got so excited, and I went to Home Depot, and I had all kinds of plants, did lots of research. I wanted all perennials and all drought hardy, and like, I wanted to plant a garden that I would water initially, but then would run on its own on God's watering system. So I did lots of research into it, and I put in soil, clay buster. We have terrible dirt in Denver, terrible. Hard to make things grow there. It's hard to dig holes in that. It's like ridiculous. Nothing like working where everything just grows, grows, grows. That's not Denver. So I spend hundreds of dollars on plants. Plant my garden. Everybody's, you know, that people say, you know, you shouldn't plant until Mother's Day, but it was so gorgeous. Gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous. So I plant away, right? Mother's Day comes. It snows. For 2 days.
Jeez.
And it's stuck. For 2 days. Everything dies. Didn't die right away. Some things died right away. They froze, and some things died right away. Right? It's the middle of May. And some things took the whole summer to die. You're thinking, maybe you're still alive. No, they're not. Of course, I bought with confidence, because Home Depot has that guarantee, perennials for a year, save your receipts, you know, and you can bring them back if they die. So I think, for sure not going to die. They have a guarantee, right? So, did I say receipts? Okay, so now come up the spring, and I'm pretty busy this year. I'm doing lots of extra things. I have another job, and hi. And somebody says, oh, what about your garden? I'm like, the garden. Stupid garden. I want to garden again. It's a ridiculous garden is what I have. So I said, oh, you can maybe plant something. I said, no, actually, I'm pretty mad at God about my garden. So it's one thing to take my kid, but to take my flowers too, that's not right. I'm surprised I said that. Like, did that just come out of my mouth? Like, I wasn't mad at God for killing my kid, but I was mad at him for killing my flowers. Like, what was that? And I was like, am I mad? So I told that story to somebody, and she said, I don't know why you're mad at God. You're the one who broke the rules. You planned it before Mother's Day. I'm like,
I am the one who broke the rules, and I'm mad at God about it. And I was also mad at Home Depot for not taking back plants that I didn't save receipts for or even try returning. They're sitting there in the corner of my garden waiting to be returned for, and I'm going to have the nerve to go in there and say, I don't have receipts, but all these plants died that you sold me. And I'm saving them. I just decided in preparing this class that I'm going to go home and throw them away. I am letting go of that. It's part of my letting go. Wow. Anyway, so that is part. So part of embracing your relationship is being in that relationship. Why are we angry? When do we feel distance? What is that distance? Is there depth in the relationship that's there? So let me just add an extra layer onto that. Okay, so I am a Jew by choice. Jew by choice of Protestant background, 13th generation American. So when I first became Jewish, before I became Jewish, I went to Camp Salomon Schefter here in Washington State. That was back in 1978. Yeah, probably 79. Anyway, so I went there. And my mother was fine. I mean, everybody in my family was like, I was the crazy child exploring many, many things. And I was in my Jewish phase. Right? I'd gone through the chakra phase and the Buddhist chanting phase and whatever other phases. Now I was in my Jewish phase. And my parents were dealing with me. It was fine. And off I go to camp. And my parents had not sat me in and said, what are you thinking? Judaism? They never asked that. They never said that. And neither did the rabbi, Rabbi Stanford. He's still healthy, right?
He's still around. Okay. Still around.
Gosh, bless him. So Rabbi Stanford was my rabbi at that time. And he never sat me down and said, Judaism, what are you thinking? He did say when I was 15 and I told him I wanted to convert, he's like, that's nice. No. What do you mean, no? I made a decision. He's like, that's very nice. You can keep coming to shul, but you can't convert. You're too young. I was like so mad at him for that. Meanwhile, though, when I went to Camp Salomon Schefter, so I'd already been involved for quite some time, there was a cantor there. And he was not the cantor of New Jerusalem. He was the cantor just for the camp, and I don't know where he came from, but he was a Holocaust survivor. And he had a torn but healed eye. His iris was torn, so he couldn't, his eyes didn't work together. And but he's the, and I went to his cabin every day to work on Hebrew, to learn Hebrew, because I was determined to read Hebrew by the time I left camp. So he's the only adult that sat me down and said, are you sure you want to cast your lot with the Jewish people? And I thought he was asking me, are you sure you want to be Jewish? So my answer was yes. And it took years to realize what he was asking me. Are you sure you want to be part of a people that are chased and displaced and sometimes always magically still here because God promised, but in a very difficult, rocky relationship with God and with others, tossed about the entire planet? Are you sure you want that? I didn't know he was asking me that. I would have answered yes, because I wouldn't have known enough to answer no at the time. But I thought the question was, do you want to be Jewish? Now, as somebody who comes from, the reason why I mentioned Protestant background is because that is basically the founders of the country were largely Protestant. The Judeo-Christian ethic brought over by the Protestants. So, and as a 13th generation American, I felt very much at home here. Like, why would I ever consider that I don't belong somewhere? Or that I can't trust the police or the government. So as a Jew by choice, I come with that. No transgenerational trauma. None. Whole background, clean. See? None of it back there. There's no transgenerational trauma. But Jews by birth, gobs. Gobs of it. Right? Which makes the relationship with God much more difficult. So here I have this husband, born into a, you know, Jewish family, back from Sinai, raised in a very Sabbath-centered, not fully Sabbath-observant, very Sabbath-centered home, Shabbos every week, kosher kitchen, you know, very traditional. And he's doing the dance with Hashem. Love you, hate you, you're in my way, you're empowering me. I like your mitzvahs, but they're really annoying. You know? And there's this, all this going on inside his heart. And Jews by choice don't have that. You know, they see, wow, God, your Torah is so amazing. I totally want it. And the whole thing. Okay, it might be hard to keep parts of it, right? Short skirts could be too short. You get the skirt extender, right? So you just wear that with it, right? So, all right, so you have to deal with that, right? So, but you're into the program, right? You see the mission, the vision, you want it. That's great,
right? And meanwhile, other people are looking at you saying, are you sure you want to be Jewish? Something must be wrong with you. Because if God would tell me I'm Protestant, I would say, thanks for the ticket out. A lot of people feel that way. I actually asked for a long time, I asked people, what would you do if you found out you're not Jewish? I sometimes still will ask a group of 20-somethings if I'm speaking to them, just to write it down so that they won't talk to each other about it. And I look at it afterwards. I just want to know, what would they do if they found out they're not Jewish? Wow.
Or people who say they don't believe in God and they aren't Jewish.
There's plenty of people.
I have friends who say,
so
I don't
Jewish.
Believe God's gone, they're gone, and I don't believe in him. And I'm just like, you don't believe in God and you're still Jewish? Why don't you leave? You know, if you don't believe in God, why are you doing being part of this difficult people?
Right.
You know, you could leave. You could go celebrate Christmas with the Koreans.
Because they're Jewish.
No, I need the social. I need the cultural background.
Right.
I was like, why?
If you're going to go and celebrate Christmas, then you have to believe in Jesus Christ. Now, that's a hard thing.
No, you
thing.
Don't. You don't have to believe any of that.
That's a hard thing to believe.
Right. And a Christian atheist is different than a Jewish atheist, it turns out. It's very different approaches to atheism.
How so?
I'll just tell you a quick joke about, the Jewish kid from an atheist Jewish family misbehaving in school like crazy. I don't know what to do with him. He's kicked out of this school, he's kicked out of that school. What's the solution? Catholic school. Right? They send him to Catholic school because they know how to put everybody in line, right? Catholic. So off to Catholic school he goes, and he comes home from school, and he tells his parents, did you know that there's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost? And his father looks at him and says, listen, get this straight. There's only one God, and we don't believe in him. So there are differences that way. It actually does turn out that there's differences. I happen to know because I am the mother of an atheist Jewish child. So that atheist Jewish child did a lot of atheist-sizing and evangelistic atheism in the very beginning of their process by watching lots of YouTube videos of actually Christian exits. And Christian exits from their philosophy. So a lot of the questions that they asked were Christian questions on Jewish texts. Hard to explain, I'm not going to go into that deeply, but it came from a Christian theological perspective instead of from a Jewish theological perspective, so the atheism is actually differently flavored, depending on what kind of background one has. Okay, back to Av. And our distance here.
Yeah? Turn the fan off.
Or maybe I'll just turn it.
Yeah. Just turn it off.
Yeah.
There's probably just a knob you can twist.
Should I turn it all the way up, or do we want the air still to be circulating?
Cool.
See how that works, and you'll let me know if you want to back out. Yeah? Okay. Where was I? Let's see. Oh, yeah. Okay, so what are we actually missing? How can we feel the distance right now when the distance that we're trying to feel is the exile of the Shekhinah, the exile of God, the exile of the Jews, the exile of God's presence, the destruction of the temple? It's not about the building not being there. It's that the building represents the consonance of God's presence with the Jewish people and the synergy of the Jews to be able to channel God in this world and spread shalom. And since we broke the rules and made it so that that consonance wasn't working, so God took away the temple so that that tool wasn't there, and now we mourn the loss of that, but we don't even know what we're mourning. So when I lived in Long Beach, Long Island, and I had my pack of 6 kids in 7 years that I was raising as a bunch, moving through all the stages in bunches, of course, like every mom, I was thinking, how can I add to the bottom one? Like, we don't have enough money in this house, and we need a little bit more, because I would like help, and how will I pay for that? And my grandmother actually was very kind, and for baby number 5, gave me a year of live-in help. But 1 year does not do the trick, let me tell you. Once you have a year of it, you need living help after that. So how was I going to replace that after that year, especially since I was expecting? So babysitting, that's how you do it. I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom. So I took in 2 kids of a single mom. Right? It was a toddler and a baby. And they're the same ages as my kids. Approximately the baby was younger than my kids, but the toddler was the same age as my youngest. And a babysat for them. And the mom was single, and she got divorced while she was pregnant with the second. So, and these were my daytime children. I had them every day. They were dropped off at 7 a.m., dressed, with their lunches packed. That was nice.
And then I just had to get my kids up, dressed and ready. So those kids, well, when they were toddler and baby, they just came dressed with their diaper bags and everything. And then as they grew, I had them for years. Then their mom would drop them off dressed and ready for school. I'd put them on the bus, take them off the bus, and feed them dinner, and she'd pick them up. So they were my daytime children. So the youngest one never knew the relationship of her parents, and the oldest one hardly did, and he was a baby. And then they got divorced when she was pregnant with the second one. So I thought to myself, child of divorce, child of very nice divorce, the nicest one I ever saw. My parents are sort of like first cousins today. Like, you know, not pals, but related.
I have one of those.
In the orbit, yeah?
Very friendly with my ex.
Oh, and nice. Yeah. Nice, yeah. So a very nice divorce. But I'm thinking, this girl is never going to know the pain of divorce because she didn't know marriage. So this is all she knows, is being like this, living with her mom and her brother in an apartment, basement apartment. That's it. That's her life. So she doesn't know anything different. So she will never experience the pain of divorce. Until she was old enough that it was time to go to dad's every other week. So every other Friday, mom would drop them off, and dad would pick them up. And when her mother would leave, she would sit in my lap and cry and cry and cry. And I thought, these are tears of divorce. These tears on my lap is this child feeling the pain of her parents' separation, and she never knew their togetherness. This is like the month of Av for us. Somehow we have to figure out how to access the pain of the separation of God's presence with this people, and we never knew what it was like for it to be together. We never experienced that, the total connection and the ability for us to really live the way that we're supposed to live in connection with God, in the land, being a light into the nations. We never knew that. So how could we possibly mourn what we've lost when we don't know what that is at all? So that's an exploration that every person has to do on their own. I can't tell you what it is. I'm also one of those children of divorce, but think about it in that way a little bit. What is it like to be a child of divorce? Whether, I have a friend whose parents got divorced after she was married and had children. And we were very close. She didn't tell me they got divorced for over a year. And I thought, that is fascinating. Like when I kind of stumbled upon the fact, she's like, oh, they got divorced. She didn't want to tell me. She's embarrassed, right, that her parents didn't make it. And as a grown woman with children, and we were close, she didn't want to tell me. So she was also suffering from the divorce of her parents. What is that? There is that pulling out from under you of the stability, of the solidness of the marriage and what it is. If anybody who is married and can provide that for their children, that's a different concept. But we could think about what is that when somebody gets divorced, whether it's with young children, and then they, even if it's easy, there still is there is a lack of stability. I moved back and forth between the houses, didn't mind it at all, until my mother started going out with somebody who was newly divorced and was discussing their kids. We went back and forth every month. And my parents got along, and they lived relatively close to each other, about a mile. You could walk from one house to the other if you got your ballet shoes in one house or your notebook or an essay in another. You know, you needed that blouse with that skirt, and it was in the other place. So I had a bedroom in both places. Could manage. But then I heard this person say, yeah, we're going to do it every week. They're going to go back and forth. And I was like, no, don't do that to your children. And that was the first time I realized inside of me, I was maybe 15, like, this is hard going back and forth. Don't make it an every week thing. That's so hard. What are you going to do to them? And I just remember like telling them, no. So just what that is, that lack of stability and always having your ballet shoes in the wrong house. Always, no matter where you are, your ballet shoes are in the other place. So among other things, concepts of self and history and future and all that stuff is interrupted, right? So, and that's a good divorce, much worse than difficult divorces, right? So this is a difficult divorce, that we are the children of the divorce between the Jewish people and God. It's not a full divorce. That is his Shekhinah in exile. It is that presence away from us. And it's the Shekhinah in exile inside ourselves, too. Because we know that God said, build for me a Mishkan,
right? Va'asuli mikdash. Asuli mikdash v'shachanti b'tochem. Make for me a tabernacle, and I will dwell in you. I'll dwell in you, right? Not in it, right? Make for me, do this physical thing, build this building. Once you've done it just the way I said, the process of building that makes space inside you for me to live inside you, because that's where I want to live, so God. So the exile is not just God's exile from the land or exile from the building or exile from the people. It's also an exile inside of us. But Rav Dessler explains that there is an exile of God's spark inside of us. Let me just see if I see his language here. And Rav Dessler, who was a Musar teacher, philosopher in the early part of the last century. He talks about vanquishing the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, and what it can be. Let me just see if I want to read any of this out. Wow, it's interesting. I'll just read this thought because we did talk about it too. So there are occasions when he talks about how to confront that evil inclination, either by guile, like it confronts us, right? Because it comes and tempts us and says, wouldn't you rather do this? Wouldn't you rather do that? You know, and can just like make us little by little by little drop our guard and lose our whatever it is. Or sometimes it stands right in our way. If it stands right in our way, sometimes it's easier, right? So look, let's just say you were working on keeping kosher, or you've made a commitment to keeping kosher. You're hungry, and there's a yogurt right there that has just a K on it. Well, let's make it. There's a yogurt right there that has no hechsher. You keep kosher, you're not eating it. What if there's a K? You're really hungry. Could it be kosher? Is it even kosher? You don't usually go with a K, right? But in this case, like, it's probably kosher. It says on the thing, kosher gelatin. That's the Yetzer Hara coming and just doing, like, a little bit. Let me just, like, give you a little bit, take you into a little place. It's not the perfect example, but, like, it is possible that it can be a little bit. Like, I see, for instance, you know, in speaking a Lashon Hara and speaking negative things about others, we're permitted and even required to do that if it will save somebody in a marriage or in a business situation. If you know firsthand, not by rumor, that that person financially cheats, and now somebody says, I'm going into business with that person, you could say, I was in business, you have to say, I was in business with that person and he stole. You can't say, don't go into business with him. You have to just give your information, that's it. So you're allowed to tell it for a constructive purpose. But I see that among religious people, a lot of times people will say, this is for constructive purposes. So, did you know that? And they just proceed it with that, and they think it's total license to say, right? So that's the Yetzer Hara coming in that guiling way, or it can be right in front of us. So it says, if you want to confront it, there's, you can confront the Yetzer Hara in both of those ways, but with the needless tears, it has to be dead on. There are occasions when this method cannot be used the guile way. One has to raise himself to a vantage point where he can see through that Yetzer Hara completely, and vanquish it in direct combat. One of these times is the redemption of the Shechina from its exile, which is the goal of mourning on Tisha B'Av. The redemption of the Shechina is the rescue of one's own spark of truth from its exile among the forces of evil. And this demands absolute truthfulness. So then it goes on to talk about what was that that God said, I'll give you something to cry about. What he's saying is, I love you so much, I have to create a program for you to come into truth with this relationship. And it's going to hurt. I'm going to have to give you things that will cause pain and tears so that you'll see that your redemption of that spark of truth is not going to come from that direction. It has to come from a deep, intense self-knowledge. It has to come from really examining yourself and your relationship with God and writing that relationship in ways that are unique to every individual. No, there's no magic formula for this. But it's a process of really working on it. But it's going to take tears. It's going to take loss. It's going to take pain. It's going to take sorrow on an individual and on a collective level. And that's part of why the Jews have experienced collectively so much. And thank God, right now, in this generation, we are pretty safe. We should only remain safe. Mm-hmm. Hashem should listen to our prayers and destroy all those thoughts and deeds of those who want to do us harm and anybody who wants to make nuclear things that will hurt us, for sure. Anyway, right now, in general, we're safe. This generation has not, most of the people in this room have not, some people are a little older, but most of the people in this room have not experienced collective Jewish sorrow. Right? That has, for most of the people in this room. But I would say all the people in this room, I'm pretty sure, because I've spoken to enough of a sampling, have experienced something really bad. Really hard. Really difficult. Whether it's the loss of somebody dear to you, whether it's financial problems or marital problems or children with learning issues or health issues or personal health issues, whatever it is, we all have stuff. And a lot of stuff. No family is immune and no person is immune. So our Rav in Denver, Rabbi Yehuda Kahan, who's now in Cleveland, but he spoke once about how we do need, for whatever reason, whatever constructive purposes, and God runs the world, so he gets to decide, and we have to trust him on this. We need whatever sorrow we have. We don't have the outside sorrow, so it's coming from the inside out, that we all have it inside. And it actually, in a way, makes it harder to deal with, because there's not the collective to deal with it with, right? If you have a kid who's mentally ill, you're alone in that. If you have cancer, so now there's Caring Bridge, so you can work with that, but you're still alone in that. You're the one who has to go through it, and nobody really understands what it is, right? So, I mean, people do create support groups for some things like that that now people will talk about. They didn't used to. It was just Yana Macha, you know, that she has that. It used to be that Jews didn't talk about it. I think probably there were other cultures, too, that didn't talk about it. But that, and we're still that way with mental illness. People don't talk about it, right? People have it, just so you know. It's around. I think that's the next thing. We have learning disabilities. We're willing to admit, as Jews who prize our brains, right? As Woody Allen said, it's his second favorite organ. but as people who prize our brains, we are now willing as a group to say some people's brains have stuff that makes it harder for them to learn. It took us a long time to be able to say that, and now we have resource rooms pretty much in every school, and we're okay with that. That's been the last, I'd say that's the accomplishment of the last 35 years. Right, 40 years ago, it wasn't the case. Everybody's still hush-hush. Mental illness is that hurdle now for us to be able to say, yeah, it's there, right? And God created it.
You say for us, you mean?
Us Jews. Us Jews, I think us others, but for sure us Jews. We definitely need to relate to that in our communities. That we have it, yeah?
Just to recap and make sure I understand, if anybody else. So are you saying that when we had... when we were suffering on a collective whole, so there wasn't as much individual suffering because it was being experienced by everyone together?
No, I wasn't necessarily. I was saying there was a fellowship in the collective suffering.
Okay.
And there's an additional layer of suffering right now is the aloneness in the suffering.
I see.
That's what I'm saying. That makes the suffering in a way harder, that we suffer often alone. We don't want to tell somebody about our marital things or our financial things or our mental things or our physical things. Right. And sometimes even if we do, they can't. Like, there's not a sharing. Not that it's any bad. I mean, it's definitely bad to be in a Spanish expulsion or a pogrom, but everybody's in it together. There is something about fellowship in it.
Right.
And here we are alone. And that makes it hard. So let's talk about how then. Okay, so that's what the gap is that spark of truth in distance, our relationship with God in distance. That's where we are. And everybody has to do their own exploration of what that distance means and being in that distance and... But how do we close the gap? Let's talk about that for a few minutes. But before I move on to the closing the gap, anybody, any more questions on this part? Not that it's all going to be completely answered.
I just
answered,
was but. Thinking African Americans often expressed that when they were all in the South under Jim Crow, there was that collective oppression that they all had a certain fellowship, like to use your words. And now that they're more dispersed and they don't have that oppression as a group, there's a new kind of loneliness. And I mean, it's better... Of course, not to have that collective oppression, but it's also different and a little lonely, and they're not as bound together in fellowship.
Right,
so
So there is that. It can serve a role in that.
Yeah.
And uniting for a cause is also something. I mean, we don't, as Jews today, we don't necessarily have something that we're united around. Like, you know, back in my day, as my kids would say, even when you used to be alive, did you? Yes, back in that day when I used to be alive, there was a struggle for Soviet Jewry. You know, we wrote letters and we wore bracelets and we knew the names of the refuseniks and we gathered money and we went to Russia and we sent stuff and like there was a uniting around a cause. Went to Congress and lobbied and memorized things and talked about it and like all that stuff. We don't have that today. We have much more, we're fractionated people. So we have that going on too, that we just have the fractionation of our people and nothing, we aren't united. I can't say nothing to unite us. There's probably stuff that could unite us, but we haven't yet chosen to unite in that way. So,
like last summer in Israel, and they had everything, so that was a very unifying moment for people in Israel.
And around the world. How sad that we need sorrow to unite us, right?
Yeah.
And that is the message of Rachel Frankel and the other mothers who lost their sons in that tragedy, to say unity, not uniformity, and let's unite without tragedy.
Right.
And we still haven't pulled it off. And I hope that we'll manage it without tragedy, because really that's our quest. Is how can we create a sense of unity, not uniformity, unity without tragedy, where it comes from a place of recognizing our goals and our mission and how we want to unite in that and see the synergy of everyone behave in a synergistic way, where we see everyone's contributions and embrace them and appreciate them. So it's something we need to work towards. Meanwhile, let's start by working within our own relationships and families and our relationship with God. Right? How can we move? I'm reading an interesting book right now, which I'm not necessarily recommending. I'm reading, and it's a very Christian book, but it has interesting ideas. It's called The Four Seasons of Marriage. And it talks about summer, spring, winter, fall as seasons, types, fall being getting cold or winter being a very cold place in marriage, spring being so hopeful, effervescent, new relationships. Right, that aren't really built yet, and the hope and the energy of that newness, and summer being in that really lovely, warm place of a built relationship. You're just kind of glowing in the relaxation of really feeling secure in your love, and how to move your relationship from fall or winter into spring and summer, and how to keep it in spring and summer, and the strategies that they have. I wanted to read it because I wanted to understand that marriage book in relationship to our relationship with God. What if we're feeling winter in our relationship with God? Do we have to call that a loss of faith? And I say no. I say that's part of a relationship with God, is being in a winter place. We don't have to see that as a loss of faith. We could see that as I'm in a cold spot. And there are strategies to move it into a warmer spot. I want to move that into hope, and I want to move that into creating a relationship of warmth and comfort and security. And I can take proactive steps. So Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, I read an article that he wrote, and he talked about the difference between optimism and hope. He said, optimism is when you hope, when you're thinking that things will get better. Hope is when you know that you could work hard enough to make them better. So we want to be agents of hope, to see the hope and reach towards it and to make it happen. That it's in our control. We get to choose the relationship that we want to live in. It's completely in control. Especially the more you learn about God, the more you learn that God is a God of love. He runs the show for the good. You have to learn that and experience that. But another one of Rabbi Kahan's sayings, and this is one of my favorite jokes on the planet. What is the difference between a Jew and God? Anybody? God knows everything. And the Jew knows better. Don't we all think that? Like, really, if I could arrange things, I actually would have done it this way. Actually, God knows better, it turns out. Right? And he's got our backs. He really does. So if he's doing it and it's difficult, it must be for a reason. It must be for a constructive reason. So we can only learn that experientially in our lives and come into that relationship of knowing that we are in a relationship of love. And that we get to control then the tenor of the relationship. If we're not in summer, it's because we broke the rules somehow, or we can take responsibility, or we can start seeking ways to bring it into spring and summer. That's up to us. Because God's there, all loving, all the time. All loving, all the time. And it just depends on how we turn ourselves towards God to receive that. So, and that's an intellectual turning, it's an action turning, it's a relationships in our lives turning all kinds of ways, but we get to pick that. So in our human relationships, I'll give you just a couple of tools. One is hope, right? And the next is, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, maybe not in this room, but my favorite tool, which is skip step two. Step two is a very destructive place. Step two is what creates division, and difficulty and lack of optimism and hope in a relationship. Step two is anger, shame, embarrassment, frustration. Step one, something difficult happens. Step two, you get mad about it or blame somebody. Step three, you deal with it. We could start to recognize when we're in step two and skip it. Right? I'll just give you an example. Your teenage child, grandchild, whatever it is, right, friend, borrows your car. Oh, they didn't ask. They bring it back with a big dent, right? You could get really mad at them. Or you could think to yourself, why do I need a dented car and a dented relationship? I anyway have the dented car. I anyway have to deal with it. I'm going to preserve the relationship. Doesn't mean I'm not going to require them to pay for it. Doesn't mean I'm not going to give them a lesson about respecting boundaries and rules and all that kind of stuff. It doesn't have to come from a place of anger or shaming or blaming. It can just be, I can skip step two, and sometimes we can recognize when we're at step two, but I could skip step two and move right to, okay, let's deal with the situation. Sometimes you can skip it completely, and sometimes you can just catch yourself when you're in step two. Sometimes the anger, blaming, and shaming is towards yourself. I was called into one synagogue there for a whole Shabbos, and but I came first to do some board work, and I interviewed the board, and I spoke with the president of the board, a young, cute guy, he's like 24, a whippersnapper kid, right, and his name is Josh. So later on that Friday night, I'm giving my talk, and I'm trying to stand there, and in a power pose, confident, you know, giving my talk, and he raises his hand, and I call on him, and I say, Zach? And he's like, Josh. And he asked the question. And I'm like, so behind me, I'm doing this. I'm squeezing my hand, squeezing. And I'm answering his question, looking confident and ever so, you know, speakerish in front. And all of a sudden, I realize my hand really hurts. Why is it? Oh, it's because I'm squeezing it. Oh, because I'm in step two. I'm punishing myself for making a stupid mistake. Behind me, I'm in step two. And in front, I'm already in step three. But I have to punish myself a little bit for being stupid behind me, right? So I'm blaming, shaming myself for that. And so I released my hand. And I realized, like, I do not have to be in step two about this. Let's just move right into step three and continue the conversation. It was a little bit embarrassing, but you can deal with that and just move forward. Right? So sometimes it's about yourself. Sometimes it's about somebody else. Right? I went to Israel, I have my kitchen color-coded red, blue, green. Green is power, right? Green tape gets really sticky on the knives and always slides off. You want a green knife to cut your vegetables with. And sticky tape, it's gross. My kids hate it. I bought a green-handled knife. The whole handle is green in Israel. Right? No sticky, and everybody could tell it's screaming parv, right? Everywhere you look, parv. Blinking, parv. Right? I open up the dairy dishwasher, and there it is. Steam coming out. And a big green handle, blinking. Used to be parv, used to be parv, used to be parv.
Stick it in the ground.
I know. I take it out, and I'm like, who put my brand new parv knife in the dairy dishwasher? And the kids say, Ima, skip step two. I'll just put this on the koshering pile then, won't I? I don't have to know who did it or why it happened. It did happen.
It did happen, yeah.
That's it. Now I have to kosher it if I want to be parv again, or I have to put blue tape on it. Better I should kosher it. So that you can use it in small things, like a knife. You could use it in bigger things, like a car accident. You could use it in big things, like you're visiting somebody, and they're getting you to the airport, and they left late because of whatever, and now you're stuck in traffic, and you're like, I don't know if I can make that flight. And they're starting to say, I'm really sorry. I can't believe it. Shalom, I didn't know there'd be so much traffic. It's half an hour to the airport. And you could just say, you know what? We have half an hour together. Let's not worry about that. That's step two right there. Let's skip step two and enjoy the time that we have together. When I get to the airport, I'll figure out what to do about it. But I certainly don't need to waste this half hour in step two when this is the time that we have together. Bless you.
Thank you.
So, and when I get to the airport, I'm either going to make the flight or not make the flight. And if I don't make the flight, I'm either going to have to pay or not pay. And I'm either going to make it to the next destination on time or not. Right? So I'll deal with that then. And right now, let me be in right now. And let's have a nice conversation right now. Right? What do you want to talk about? Right? So this is a tool that is really helpful. You have to practice it because it does not work right away. And it's not about denying your emotions, although sometimes there's a little fake it till you make it going on. Mm-hmm. But it's not about denying your emotions. It's choosing to not experience that. And sometimes you realize, oh, I'm in step two, I can release it. And sometimes I even do that to release it because it needs to be released. But to skip it. So that's something that really can help. So you can do that with Hashem too. Right? You can say, I didn't actually get this. It's because I think I know better. I'm Jewish. Ah, surprise. I think I know how to run the world better than God. But I recognize I don't. So I'm going to skip that. Blaming, shaming, being frustrated at you, God. And I'm going to say, all right, you know what you're doing. Why don't you just do what you know how to do? I'll try to live with it. Right? So we could work on that. Okay, so I'm just going to do one, I think. Well, I'll just do two more quick tools. These are tools that God uses. They're part of his 13 attributes of mercy. One of them, and these 13 attributes of mercy are discussed at length in a book called Tomer Devorah. If anybody wants to learn it, call Eve. She'll call me. Well, I'll teach it to her and she'll get class. or you can go online and look
it up. I have to go.
Okay, good. Anyway, tool number six, trait number six of God is Chafetz Chesed. God loves Chesed. And in fact, it discusses that God has a Chesed museum. That he actually collects examples of Chesed.
Wow.
He stores them. And when he's mad at the Jews, he has his angelic curators of the collection bring it out so we can look at it first before he decides what to do. It helps elicit in him compassion so that he can behave. So it's a metaphor, of course. Nevertheless, this is one of his attributes of mercy, is that he loves chesed, so he collects it. We look for things that we collect. Right? I bet when you go into an antique store, you look for tea kettles, right? You have a collection. So you think, or at least in other people's houses, you notice them, right? You notice them because it's a collection that you have. Maybe you don't want to add to it, but you notice. I'm a tea kettle person. You know? I notice them. Right? Because it's a collection. So if we start to collect, we collect what we care about, even if it just happens, right? But then we start to care. So we can proactively start to collect chesed. Collect examples of goodness in others. Look for it. So moms having a hard time with a particularly difficult child, one of the things I did to help this was take a picture of that kid cute. Put it on your fridge.
And look at it.
To remind yourself of the kid that you love when the kid that you were ready to strangle is in front of you, right? So that you could remember, oh yeah, okay, right. But sometimes something really super cute happens on Shabbos. Just do like that. That's what, just capture it. Like pretend you're taking a picture. Say, I'm capturing that for my chesed collection. And catch it. Catch those moments so that you start to look for them and collect them so that you are seeking examples of beauty in others, examples of kindness, examples of their goodness, so that you actually have that. And that helps close the gap too. That helps bring back truth. And we can focus on the truth of how kind those people are, how good those people are. And that maybe they're out of sync in some ways, but I want to focus on the truth of their goodness and call that forth in them. And finally, strategies. Right, then we have to make sure that our strategy, so number five of his character traits that he manifests is lo achzik la'ad apo. He doesn't stay angry forever. God's anger is only a tool. And he only stays angry enough to bring us back in line. And if we're not being brought back in line, he stops. And he'll try a different method. So that he has a clear goal. The anger is never the goal. It's only ever a means. So whoever we are, whether it's in parenting, in grandparenting, in friendshiping, in co-working, whatever it is, to make sure to keep our anger or frustration or expression of those things, expression of disappointment, in check, that it's only a tool. It's definitely not, we want to use the tool that will bring us to our goal, and maybe anger is not there. Maybe the tool that will bring us to the goal is a different tool. Pick the tool that works. Keep your goal in mind. Let's just say you're a boss, right? And you might be hounding people to get their projects finished, and you're creating a negative environment in your office because you keep calling people on the carpet, which is the thing bosses need to do, right? But is it working? Are you creating a work environment in which you get the most out of your employee, where they can bring their creativity and their passion to the job, Or are you creating an environment in which they really don't want to see you, and you create an environment of malevolent obedience? Right? I'll do your job. I'll do exactly what you said. Right? Rather, you'd have somebody say, yes, I see that, and I see this possibility too. Let me do that. And you want to create an environment of synergy. Keep your goal in mind and use the method that helps you meet your goal, whether it's in marriage, whether it's in parenting, whether it's in work, whether it's in your relationship with God. What works for you? What do you need to be in a better relationship with that person or with the master of the universe? So I just want to end with a blessing that we should all feel some of the distance, be in touch with the pain. We don't have to run away from it. Feel it a little bit, but feel it enough that we can now use it as a creative force to bring it into relationship, bring ourselves into relationship, bring those around us into relationship, and that we could make space inside ourselves for God to live there, not in exile, but front and center, so that we are shining the light of God in this world, and really the kind of people that will hopefully bring our exile to an end very speedily in our day.
Thank you.